We
are.
We
are.
We are Cultivate.
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 We are Cultivate.
A missing daughter, a 3-page ransom note, and a wealthy, well-known family left in devastation. One would be forgiven for thinking that the situation is as bad as it can get. But sadly, when the body of a 6-year-old was found in the family's basement just hours later, the Ramsey family would soon find that was not the case. Join Dom and I as we discuss the killing of John A. Ramsey. Good day to you, our fellow weirdos, and welcome to episode 40. I want to say 40.
Yeah,
I'm pretty 40. Sure it's 40 of Horror House True Crime the Club. Thank you for joining us and for listening. But more importantly, thank you for being an absolutely wonderful human being. We love you simply for being. Dom, I think I already know the answer to this question, but how are you?
Yeah, I'm doing great. I have been dying a death for the past 4 days, but no, I'm okay, slowly getting better. I'm excited to be recording. I'm excited to hear about this case. I know of it, but I don't really know much about it, so I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Okay, that's good. I think JonBenet Ramsey is to me what DB Cooper is to you.
Okay,
like that's how in it I am. I need to. It's unsolved, and I need it to be solved. I need to, you know, get my head around it. I think it's a similar sort of level in terms of obsession.
No, definitely. I think a lot of people have said that as well. I know podcasts have covered it as well, and they've said that it's sort of a holy grail case for a lot of people. So yeah, if it's your DB Cooper, then I'm very excited to hear more about it.
Good. And I'm pleased to hear that you don't know too much about it, because otherwise this would be very boring for you. Nope. I have tried to trim it as much as possible, because there is a lot that can be said about this case, but I've tried to make it nice and concise and let people draw their own conclusions. But I do need to say a quick thank you regarding this episode, because I was having a bit of trouble deciding on my topic for this one. I had 3 lined up, and I was really having issues choosing. So okay. I consulted our patron, Laura, who helped me decide and agreed that this one was the one to delve into. So thank you for helping me decide that. But before we get into it, I am going to tell you a little bit about one of the just delightful ways that you can contribute to the podcast, known as our Buy Me a Coffee link, which I'm stealing this week because I described that better than I described Patreon. So I'm going to talk about Buy Me a Coffee, and then I'll hand over to Dom to talk about Patreon. I think that's fair.
I thought the way you talked about the Patreon last week was actually hilarious. I thought it was hilarious.
Well, maybe in that case, like, I should describe Buy Me a Coffee as an impression of you, and you can describe Patreon as an impression of me.
Okay. I'm intrigued as to what this impression of me would be like when you describe the Buy Me a Coffee link.
I'm not gonna like do a voice or anything. I'm not gonna like put on a Dom voice. That'd be weird. But I can describe it in the way that I think you would describe it. I think that'd be
okay.
Fun. Okay.
I'm down.
Cool. So we another voice. I can't not. Okay, this is a bad idea. I'm just gonna describe it. So Buy Me a Coffee. It is a way to support the podcast without any monthly subscription. Sorry, I'm just chucking stuff across the room now. I'm so outraged. You can click the link. You can buy us 1 coffee, 2 coffees, 3 coffees, whatever you prefer. And it's a great way to support us a little bit financially, help us keep doing what we're doing. Tell us that you love us, and we'll tell you that we love you. It's a nice way of doing that. Simple, easy, one time, no subscription, no sneaky payments out of your bank account, just a nice little one-off way to support us and give us a bit of a pick-me-up, which we very much need, particularly Dom at the moment, because he sounds like death.
Yeah.
But that being said, try and get through it, man up for a minute, and or woman up, and tell us about the Patreon in your best Amy way.
I don't do a voice. I can actually put on an Amy voice. That's the thing. I think my voice is way too deep to even like try. it wouldn't work. So, we have, in addition to the Buy Me a Coffee link, we also have another way you can support us, which is called Patreon. And with the Patreon, there are different tiers. One is a price. The other one is a bit more than the first tier.
Sorry, carry on. This is going great. Don't die.
So for these two tiers, one being relatively inexpensive, the other being still relatively inexpensive, but a little bit more than the other tier, you get little perks such as early access to episodes. You get a bonus episode a month. And yes, you also get ad-free episodes as well. And all of that for £4 a month, which I think is a pretty good deal. And it helps support the show, helps us produce content, you know, gives us opportunities to, you know, network, potentially, you know, go to different events and stuff like that. So, you know, it's a good way to support the show if you want to, you know, financially, you know, support us. And as always, a big shout out to our patron, Laura. She is flying the flag for the patron. She listens every Thursday for that early access. So your support is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much. But yes, that is the Patreon. I tried to make it as Amy-like as possible.
Yeah, I'm realizing that making things Amy-like is basically just not knowing anything and trying to blag it anyway. Which is fine. You know, I'll take that. I fully admit that I don't prepare as much as Dom does for these things. So, you know, it's not a problem. I can take that kind of criticism.
I was only joking. That wasn't a shot at you. I was just yanking your chain, pulling your leg.
Pull the other one. It's got bells on.
For winding you up.
Righty-ho. Should we talk about JonBenet Ramsey? Because that's what we're here for.
Let's discuss.
Okie dokie. So JonBenet Ramsey was born on the 6th of August 1990 to parents Patricia Patsy Ramsey and John Bennett Ramsey. I've just realised something, and that is that she was born in the same year I was, which is pretty irrelevant, but would mean that she'd be the same age if she had lived, which is actually kind of sad.
We've started this off on a sad note. Good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the death of the child is never going to be particularly, you know, happy, but yeah.
That's true.
You know, just a little extra tidbit for you there. She also had an older brother named Burke, who was born in 1987. JonBenet's first name combined her father's first and middle names, and then her middle name was Patricia, which was her mum's name. They weren't particularly creative in naming her, I don't think.
Yeah, no, they weren't. I mean, there are worse names that you could give someone for sure, but...
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, I just think it's a bit strange because John Bennett Ramsey had kids before this. He was married previously. Before getting married to Patricia. So he'd already had kids. But he clearly wanted one of his children to be like fully named after him, because not only did he use both, he combined both of his first names and then gave it to a girl.
Yeah, that is a bit odd.
It's a bit strange, right? Like, you will be named after me, child, no matter what.
No matter what gender you come out as, you are.
You're getting a boy name.
You're getting a boy
name. I mean, to be fair, I quite like it. I do quite like it. You know, it works. It's just a bit strange. I don't think John Ramsey was the sort of man that you could say no to. He was a businessman, and he was the president of Access Graphics, a computer software company that later became a subsidiary of Martin, like a big computer company. And Patricia didn't work because she didn't need to, because he was raking in, as we'll find out shortly. In 1991, John had moved with Patsy and the family to Boulder, Colorado, where Access Graphics headquarters was located. So he moved for his job. Patsy spent her time entering JonBenet in various child beauty pageants in Boulder. She was a huge part of the child beauty pageant scene, as she had been in pageants when she was younger, so she wanted the same for her daughter.
Yeah.
JonBenet won titles like America's Royal Miss, Little Miss Charlevoix, I believe is how you say that. Little Miss Colorado, Colorado State All-Star Kids Cover Girl, and National Tiny Miss Beauty.
God, so dang.
She's pretty successful as a child beauty queen. As child beauty queens go, she's doing all right.
Successful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. I never know how to feel about like child beauty pageants. I get why like parents do it, but at the same time, I'm just like, is it really necessary for like a, I don't know how old they are. Like, I don't know what, is it really necessary for like an 8-year-old kid to be so laser focused on that? And, you know, I've seen kids that don't even want to do it, but they're pushed into it by their parents, which is even worse. So yeah, I don't know how to feel about like child beauty pageants.
It's strange. I mean, I think, so JonBenet was 6 at the time of her death. So she'd won all of those titles before.
Yeah.
So it's a lot to have done in the run up kindergarten, basically. Like, it's a lot. And yeah. Don't get me wrong, this kid, like, when you see pictures of her, she's beautiful. And that is why this case, I think, garnered such interest, because she was a stunning little girl. And obviously, the family was quite well off. Patsy kind of had this like stage mother type persona where she had been in pageants when she was younger, and that all kind of got put in the press. So I think the beauty pageant element of it is maybe one of the reasons why this is such a well-known case and such, you know, there was such press interest in it, because you put her picture on the front of a newspaper and people are going to pick it up.
That's true.
On the 26th of December 1996, Boxing Day, day after Christmas, Patsy realized that her daughter had gone missing after she found a 3-page handwritten ransom note in the kitchen, the family's residence. The note demanded $118,000 was a bit odd. But John Ramsey pointed out that this was actually the identical amount to his Christmas bonus that he'd been given it. Number one, he'd been given a $118,000 Christmas bonus. What the hell?
His Christmas bonus was $118,000.
Yes. Fuck. Like, John Ramsey, what are you doing for that bonus, mate?
I studied the wrong degree. Fucking hell.
It's crazy, what does he do? Right? He's in computers. I can't be more technical than that, I'm afraid.
He's a computer man.
He's a computer man
with computers.
Exactly. But yeah, he was earning good money. But yeah, the ransom note demanded exactly £118,000, which is the exact same amount as his Christmas bonus. And he did point that out to police when they first arrived on the scene, because obviously that is incredibly suspicious. There's no way someone's picking out that number just randomly and it happened to be a coincidence. So they must have known how much his Christmas bonus was. The real crime.
I thought you meant that he said that to police as just like a brag. Just like the ransom was $118,000. Oh, by the way, that was my Christmas bonus. I just want you to know.
Yeah.
I thought that was just like a
yeah.
He was just flexing on the police. The police were just like, mate.
I mean,
I don't care how much your Christmas bonus was.
You would hope he was only telling them because it was relevant. And you would hope it was true as well. That, you know, maybe he only got like a $1,018 bonus. But he was like, no, I've got to pick this up, you know, for the for the police.
He got a $1.80 bonus. And then he was like, let's add a few zeros to that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a pretty weird number to just guess at. Unless you were someone that knew how much his bonus was and therefore knew he had access to that money. And the police did look into that. They considered employees of Access Graphics who might have known John's bonus prior to him sort of and all of that kind of stuff. But another possibility they considered, which I've added in because I thought it was quite interesting, was that it was in reference to the Bible and to Psalm 118. Psalm 118 in the book of Psalms in King James Version is, "Oh, give thanks unto the Lord, for he is good, because his mercy endureth forever." So there was like a potential lead there that maybe someone religious was trying to punish them, but I think it's just more God, likely someone knew how much he got as his bonus.
God damn you, religion. Again? Why are you so problematic? Fuck's sake.
Stop stealing children. Stop using Bible verse to just steal children. Yeah. I think that's a bit of a stretch. I don't think it was really into the Bible, because why not just, I don't know, write Psalm 118 in the corner of a ransom note rather than ask him for that amount?
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
exactly.
you could ask for like 500 grand and then say, oh, by the way, read Psalm 118. At least you get a bit more money out of it. So they do that. I think that was kind of, maybe they were looking for something that just wasn't there.
Yeah.
But what they did note,
yeah, I agree,
was that the ransom note itself was insanely long for a note that had been written at the crime scene. The police initially believed that the note was staged because it didn't have any fingerprints on it apart from Patsy's, the mum's, and the authorities who handled it. So absolutely clean of fingerprints other than hers and policemen. And the note and the pen were had belonged to the Ramseys, so it came from inside their house. So it's either the fact they've written it themselves and it was staged, or an intruder or a kidnapper or whatever has come in, found a notepad and pen and handwritten a 3-page ransom note while the family are asleep upstairs.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Like, if it was an intruder, did you just like come in, see the pad of paper, and then it was like, cool, right, let's stick the kettle on, let's make a sandwich and let's get
time
let's
to
get
write a fucking essay
on this ransom note. it's just like,
exactly,
just like the dad comes down in the middle of the night to get like a glass of milk from the fridge. I don't know why I'd be drinking milk at like 2 o'clock in the morning, but I don't know. Weirder things have happened. And you just see this person in the kitchen just with like a brew in his hand, and then you just sort of lock eyes and you're just like, you're right. Yeah,
how's it going?
Yeah, good. Just gonna get my milk. You good? You good? Do you need anything? No? Cool. Right. As you were.
Yeah, exactly. It's a long old note to sit and write in someone's kitchen when you're planning on committing a crime shortly afterward, which is why the police thought it was staged. That was why they assumed that either John or Patsy had written it. Obviously not John, because his fingerprints weren't on the note at all. So they looked at Patsy and had six individual handwriting experts look at the note in comparison to her handwriting, and they all ruled individually that it wasn't her that had written it. Wasn't her handwriting. So, you know, it's kind of a bit of a weird situation. The letter itself is quite long. It's, like I say, it's 3 pages, and it talks a lot about weird stuff and monetary amounts, and it gives really, really detailed instructions on how to get the money, what sort of bills to have the money brought to them in, what kind of bag they should bring. It even says stuff like, make sure you're well rested before you bring me this money, because, you know, it's going to be heavy and all of this kind of stuff. But I have picked out the first and last paragraphs I'm going to read to you, because they are quite interesting. And just to give you like an idea of how weird this note was, this 3-page note that apparently couldn't wait and they had to write while they were sitting there. So the note begins, "Mr. Ramsey, listen carefully." I'm not sure how he's going to listen. It's a note, but never mind. "We are a group of individuals that represent a small foreign faction. We do respect your business, but not the country that it serves. At this time, we have your daughter in our possession. She is safe and unharmed, but if you want her to see 1997, you must follow our instruction to the letter." Scary stuff.
Okay.
To begin the note. And then, as I say, it went into, you know, all these instructions on what kind of bills to use, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the letter ends, "You and your family are under constant scrutiny as well as the authorities. Don't try to grow a brain, John. You are not the only fat cat around, so don't think that killing will be difficult. don't underestimate us, John. Use that good Southern common sense of yours. It is up to you now, John. Now, I don't know who these people think they are. But what a weird way of phrasing it. They sound like, I don't know, 1920s gangsters. It's just weird.
I was about to say, you need to bust out that 1930s prohibition voice again and read the last part of that.
Oh, absolutely not. I'm not doing that again. Absolutely not. Don't go being a wise guy, John. It's just... I know that you should not have a favorite part of a ransom note that is holding to ransom a six-year-old girl. But I think my favorite part is you're not the only fat cat around. Like, don't get too big for your boots, mate. We could have stolen anyone's door.
That necessary?
Don't worry.
Just because your Christmas bonus was $118,000, John.
Yeah. Don't think you're Mr. Billy Big Bollocks. You just happened to have left a window open. Like, it's very, very sus, very weirdly worded. I know that police investigating did look at a lot of other films that included ransom notes because they thought this is just too, like, stylized to have come out of someone's brain. So they looked at that and looked at sort of references that might have been used. But yeah, it's a pretty weird ransom note. It is available online. So if you did want to go and read the whole thing, I do recommend reading it. It's very specific. It's very detailed, even to the point where they're saying things that almost sound like quite caring. They're like, okay, you want to make sure you're well rested and wrap up warm and all of this kind of stuff to deliver the money.
That's what I was about to say. Like when you read out the make sure you're well rested bit, like immediately I was just like, oh, see, the ransomers.
Sure, why not?
The ransom note writers.
The kidnappers at this stage.
The kidnappers. At least they're considerate. Like, make sure you get a good night's sleep, John. You need your 8 hours. Make sure you get your 8 hours. Have some chamomile tea the night before. Have some Horlicks.
Yeah.
Make sure you get your rest.
You got to do all of that. Just make sure you're feeling tip top because we're going to need you to carry this sack of money.
Yeah.
So we just want to make sure you're okay. Like, we want a nice, easy kidnapping here. There's no need for anyone to get sick or hurt. Let's just make it nice and smooth. So yeah, pretty long, pretty detailed ransom note, considering that it was supposedly written in the middle of the night in a hurry. But there we go. The only people that were known to be in the house on the night of the note being left and John Bonet's death were her immediate family. So Patsy and John Ramsey and their son, Burke, who was 9 years old. The ransom note contained very, very specific instructions about not contacting the police or friends, but Patsy telephoned the police anyway at 5:52 a.m. and she also called a lot of family and friends, which, to be honest, kind of annoys me. Because number one, it says don't. And number two, it's not even fucking addressed to you, Patsy. It's addressed to John.
God damn it, Patsy. Sticking your nose in.
Jeez. Bitch, mind your business.
I mean, yeah, it's probably... If a ransom note says don't call the police or friends, probably not advised that the first thing you do is call a fuck ton of your friends and the police.
Well, yeah. It's just a bit dumb. I mean, I know, what else do you do? You've got to call the police. You've got to call people eventually. You would at least like look at the situation and it'll make sure there's no immediate danger before doing so. But oh no, Patsy was like, not only, oh, here's a note addressed to my husband, I'm going to read the whole thing and then make an ill-informed decision, but also did not do that. She just immediately picked up the phone and got the police involved, which was potentially for her daughter because she didn't know it. You know, I don't know. Like, who am I to judge? Cool.
Yeah, I suppose the mothering instincts just sort of kicked in, like, without her really sort of having, you know, being able to think about it, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, I do get you would have called the police as well eventually. It's a bit worrying how quickly she did it. Anyway, two officers responded to the 911 call and arrived at the Ramsey home within 3 minutes, which is impressive in itself. 3 minutes from call to arrival. Fantastic. Well done, Colorado Boulder Police Force.
Yeah.
That's about as good as I can say for the Colorado Police Force, because they did, you know, kind of things up after that. But well done for getting quickly. They conducted a cursory search of the home, but did not find any sign of forced entry. Basement, which was locked from the outside and determined to have no point of the killer, was not searched. So they didn't go in there. They were like, this is locked. There's no way he could have got out. We'll leave it where it is for the time being. With JonBenet still missing, John Ramsey started to make arrangements to pay the ransom. While doing so, JonBenet's bedroom was cordoned for forensics because that's where they believed that she'd been taken from. They mm-hmm. believed she'd been taken from her bed. But it was the only part of the house that was cordoned. So all of the family, the friends, the families like pastor from the church, all of those people who came to the house to show support and to try and, you know, help out the family, obviously contaminated the crime scene. They came into the house, they cleaned kitchen surfaces, they wiped things down. And although they were presumably doing it to be nice and to try and help them, they obviously potentially destroyed a lot of evidence because JonBenet was the only that they weren't allowed into. Detectives then arrived expecting that the kidnappers would make further contact. Obviously, if you have done a ransom note, you're going to want to collect that money at some point, that $118,000 specifically, and not a penny more or less. But no further contact attempt was made to try and get the money. No one got back in touch with them. Nothing happened. So whether they were fumbled, I don't know. We will discuss that. At 1 p.m. that day, detective, I think this is spelt, this is pronounced, sorry, Ardent. Okay. It's A-R-N-D-T. Ardent.
A-R-N-D-T. I would probably.
Aunt. I don't know. A detective.
I don't know. I'll probably. Aunt. Yeah. Yeah. We'll go with the detective.
No, yeah. The detective. I believe her name, her first name was Linda. So Detective Linda asked John Ramsey and Fleet White, who was her family friend, to search the house to see if anything seemed amiss, presumably if anything was missing or anything like that. They obviously went downstairs and started their search in the basement, thinking that they would search bottom to top, because that would make sense. John opened the latch door, which one of the officers had looked at, but obviously they hadn't entered because they thought, well, there's no way he could get out of there. So obviously that's not going to be the case. But when he went in, John Ramsey found his daughter's body in one of the rooms in the basement. JonBenet's mouth was covered with duct tape and a nylon cord was found around her wrists. And her torso was covered by a white blanket, which was one that she had slept with. It was like her comfort blanket. So she'd obviously had it taken with her down to the basement of her bed. John picked up the body and took it upstairs. Obviously, distraught father. He's not really thinking clearly. That's his daughter. So, you know, he found her and took her straight upstairs and moved her. And when, obviously, her body was moved, it could have potentially contaminated a lot of the evidence. Forensic evidence would have been disturbed, which isn't ideal, considering that, you know, half the house has also had, could have had potential DNA evidence, has now been cleaned. There's not too much going on in the bedroom, so it's definitely not ideal. But as soon as, obviously, they realised that it was now a homicide, the Ramseys were asked to provide handwriting samples, obviously because of the note, blood and hair samples, the police, and all of the family members were interviewed. So Patricia, John and Burke, the 9-year-old. So not ideally handled and definitely not a kidnapping.
No.
Unfortunately.
No.
Which is a bit nasty. And poor John.
That's not what you want to, not what you want to uncover.
No. Particularly when police had searched the house and just decided not to go into the basement because they had a little look and thought, well, he couldn't have got out if it was locked from the outside, so we won't bother to go in. If they'd have done, she wouldn't have made there for, you know, the whole morning and into the afternoon before anyone had found her. It might not have changed the situation, but, you know, at least she would have been found a bit quicker and the family wouldn't have had that hope for a little while that she might be okay. Kind of sucks. The autopsy revealed that JonBenet had been killed by strangulation and a skull fracture. The official cause of death was asphyxia by strangulation associated with craniocerebral trauma. Not easy to say, but I think I did all right.
You smashed it.
Thank you. I've also just realized that I definitely should have done like some sort of trigger warnings at the start of this. Maybe I can, you know, go back at it. But yeah, there's a bit of potential child abuse, that thing. So if you don't hear about it, then now's the time to switch off. But there was no evidence of conventional rape, although sexual assault couldn't be ruled out. Although no semen was found,
yeah,
there was evidence that there had been a vaginal injury. At the time of the autopsy, the pathologist recorded that it appeared her vaginal area had been wiped with a cloth, which obviously isn't usual when she'd been asleep prior. But her death was obviously ruled as a homicide. I never know how to say this word, but you know the thing that you use to strangle someone that begins with a G? I think it's garrot. Garrot? Garrot?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it is garrot.
So a garrot that was made from a length of nylon cord and the broken handle of a paintbrush was tied around JonBenet's neck and had apparently been used to strangle her. So they obviously had a look around scene to see where that could have come from. Part of the bristle end of the paintbrush was found in a tub containing C's art supplies, but the bottom third of the paintbrush was never found, despite an extensive search of the house and the basement in subsequent days. The autopsy also revealed a vegetable or fruit material which may represent pineapple. That's quotes. I'm not just saying that like a weirdo. That's what the autopsy said, which JonBenet had eaten a few hours before her death. Photographs of the home taken on the day had shown that there was a bowl of pineapple on the kitchen table with a spoon in it. However, John and Patsy, both parents, both of them said that they didn't remember putting the bowl on the table and they didn't remember feeding pineapple to JonBenet. So definitely a bit strange to end up in her system somehow. She's obviously eaten it at some point. Of course, the bowl was dusted for fingerprints, and the only fingerprint that were found on the bowl belonged to her 9-year-old brother.
Oh, but
I'm letting that sink in because it's definitely a bit strange.
Absolutely. I mean, the kid's called Bert. I don't know what more you can expect. I'm joking, to all the Berks out there. Yeah.
I don't think that translates. Like in America, that's a normal name. Over here, you're like, oh, you're a bit of a Berk. Like, you're a bit of an idiot.
That's true. The American listeners are just like, what? Why is he laughing at the name Berk?
Yeah. Why is that funny?
There is a lot that gets lost in translation. No, but it is quite sus.
It is. Essentially, what it boils down to is a very suspicious ransom note, a very suspicious death of a very young girl in the basement of her own home, and just some very strange pieces of evidence that don't really make a lot of sense, like a bowl of pineapple with only her brother's fingerprints on it. Very, very strange. Lots to think about, but I think definitely a good time to take a little break. Do you agree, Doc?
Yes, I think it is a good time to mull the information over, to get my pin board and, you know,
your red string.
How in like crime shows. Yeah, they cut the pin board with a string.
Awesome. In that case, we will see you back.
Hey, Stephen.
Hey, Leo.
I love horror movies.
So do I.
I don't love that I have nobody to talk about them with.
It sucks. You see something great, you tell your friends to go see it, and they don't have the time because they have kids and a job.
They have a life.
Boring.
I know.
Imagine if there was a podcast where you could make your buddy watch a horror movie and under threat of death they had to, and then you got to talk about it, crack jokes, things like that.
That sounds wonderful.
What if we did it?
We could do it.
Under threat of death.
Yes, so much death, so much threat.
I love it. We could call it Spoils of Horror.
Great name.
And guess what?
What?
We've been doing it for 3 months.
What?
It's crazy. We're on all major podcasting platforms.
You can search Spoils of Horror on all social medias.
Come check us out. Hang out with us. Have a good time.
Join us.
If you dare.
Dun dun dun.
Hello and welcome to Horror Roulette, where you never know what you're gonna get. We're your hosts. I'm Em, and that's my brother Nick.
Each week, we spin the Wheel of Misfortune to randomly generate an episode topic, which makes our lives miserable, but this podcast listenable.
We've covered everything from the Toy Box Killer to Jack and Jill.
From Ed Wood to Black Widows, we've suffered through it all.
Find us wherever you listen to podcasts, and check us out at horrorroulette.com.
Listen if you dare.
So, welcome back. Lots to think about. and very suspicious in terms of her parents, don't you think?
Yes. I mean, you know, like you say, there was the ransom note, which is a bit of a head scratcher, because if I was an intruder, you know, if I was a kidnapper and I was, you know, coming to abduct a child from their home, I wouldn't sit down and pen a 3-page ransom note. It would be a pretty brief, here's the situation, this is what I want, play ball, or, you know, something will happen that you don't want to happen. I wouldn't do a 3-page fucking academic journal. And there's the being found in the basement of her own home, the fingerprints with her brother. Yeah, it's a bit of a strange one. I'm a bit sus of the family at the moment.
Yeah, which I think is incredibly fair. However, in December 2003, forensic investigators extracted enough material from a mixed blood sample on JonBenet's underwear to establish a DNA profile. That DNA profile belonged to an unknown male person and excluded the DNA of each of the Ramseys.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Sorry, family. I've kind of, unduly sort of sussed you on that one.
Well, don't apologize just yet, because there are a lot of ways DNA can get onto someone. A lot of different ways
DNA
can be spread, particularly when there's so many people in and out of the crime scene. It was from a very, very small sample on her underwear, which doesn't mean that it had necessarily come. You know, there's a lot of things that could have meant. Yeah. But if you're Patricia and John Ramsey and a lot of people are pointing the finger at you, and suddenly this piece of evidence comes up and says that actually it's not a DNA match with them, you're probably going to be feeling.
Yeah. Oh. That is true. Maybe there's a bit of convenience there, potentially, though.
Maybe
it's a bit convenient.
Maybe. But needless to say, there was a lot of speculation after that. There was experts, media commentators, and obviously the Ramseys themselves, who were all trying to identify potential suspects in the case. Boulder Police initially did focus exclusively on John and Patsy for obvious reasons, you know. But by October 1997, they had over 1,600 people in their index of persons of interest for the case. So a lot of people.
1,600?
1,600. Which is pretty mental when you think about it.
Yeah, that's a lot of people. You know, take the DB Cooper case, for example. That was 1,200, wasn't it? At like sort of its height, it was 1,200. So 1,600 people is madness.
Yeah, it really is. And obviously it gave birth to a lot of theories, a lot of leads in terms of reasons that people might have wanted to do this. But generally, they're boiled down to just two. The first of which being that it was a member of the family, you know, one of the three, perhaps extended family, which is an easy one to follow because the police saw no signs of forced entry into the home. You know, there was no sense that an intruder might have forced their way in, broken a window or anything like that. But what they did see was evidence of staging of the scene. So the ransom note top list. You know, it was from a notepad in their own home. It was extensively written. You know, granted, handwriting experts have ruled out Patsy, but you don't go in as a kidnapper and sit and write not only the ransom note itself, but also a draft of the note as well that was also found in the notebook. You don't sit and write that.
Jesus.
Exactly.
So this person put more planning into a ransom note that I put into any of my essays at university.
I was just about to say this ransom note is just about as long as your outline for the episode.
Right.
So yeah, they were
man obviously listens to Horror House and he's like,
it's like gotta plan it out. Gotta plan it out twice.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, alongside that, there was very little evidence for anyone breaking in, but alongside that, they also noted the Ramseys were incredibly uncooperative during the investigation. They would only speak to the police on their own terms. They didn't speak to them straight away. They were very sort of closed off and weren't particularly, you know, keen to speak. They did offer a reward for any information. They offered $100,000 reward in a newspaper ad on April 27, 1997. And 3 days later, more than 4 months after the body of their daughter was found, they submitted for the first time for formal interviews to Boulder Police. So they waited 4 months after she died to actually go into police and take part in an interview, which is pretty strange. As the parents, you would want to be, you know, as cooperative as possible, to give as much information as possible as quickly as possible.
Yeah, it doesn't make them any less of a suspect, obviously, does it? Because, you know, it's obvious, isn't it? If you don't cooperate with the police, then the police are going to look at you a bit like, well, kind of seems like you might have something to hide if you're being difficult and you're not talking to us and you're not requesting interviews and you're not doing this and, you know, you're being very difficult to work with. It doesn't help their case.
No.
And like you say, you know, you would expect them to be very cooperative.
You would. I mean, even in situations sort of don't involve your own child. Like, for example, I was unfortunate enough to witness a car accident. The police showed up very quickly. I was obviously still there. And my first instinct was to speak to the police, to say, this is what happened. I saw the whole thing. This is what went on. Because you want to help solve something. So, and that was a stranger. That was something I didn't know.
Yeah.
So if that was my own child and I'd suspected that something, you know, horrible had happened to them, that someone had murdered my child, I would want to do whatever I could to be able to help that investigation come to a conclusion as quickly as possible. But the Ramseys waited 4 months before doing anything, which is just strange to me.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, isn't it? Especially, you know, it's their own child. So why wait 4 months?
Exactly.
You know, it's crazy.
Exactly that. Not helped by the fact that in 1999, a Colorado grand jury voted to indict parents for child abuse and said that they did, again, quote unquote, unlawfully, knowingly, recklessly, and feloniously permit a child to be unreasonably placed in a situation that posed a threat of injury to the child's life or health, which resulted in the death of JonBenet. It is pretty intense. And again, I'm quite impressed that I managed to read that out. But, you know, it's not suggestive of parents that are particularly devastated.
Well, exactly. They didn't seem too devastated by it if they waited to, you know, to you know, go to the police. So, yeah, the parents are... I'm back to being a bit sus of the parents now. I've flip-flopped back to my original position.
Yeah, and it is difficult.
I just want to say that you reeled off those four words like a true professional.
That was
smashed it.
Oh, that BBC training.
I know that if I tried it, I would have done maybe one, and then it just would have been a fucking disaster.
Yeah, that's the parents. But obviously, there is no crime without motive, generally. So what's the motive? One theory is that Patsy, the mother, struck JonBenet in a fit of rage after a bedwetting episode. JonBenet was a bedwetter. She'd done it a lot. So in a fit of anger, there's an idea that she struck her, obviously resulting in the blow to the skull, and then strangled her to cover up what had happened without realizing that she actually wasn't. However, Patsy...
Yeah.
was not that sort of person. She wasn't known to have a history of uncontrolled anger. And JonBenet's brother Burke himself said, you know, much later about his mother, "We didn't get thanked." Sorry, this is a quote from him. "We didn't get thanked. Nothing of the sort. Nothing close. Nothing near laying a finger on us, let alone killing a child." So, you know, she's not known for being particularly violent. You know, I do think that's a bit extreme as well. Like, this is quite a widely believed theory. You know, she hit her, didn't mean to kill her, but she suffered a blow to the skull, and then obviously JonBenet passed out. So thinking that she killed her, she had killed her, she strangled her and put her in the basement to try and make it seem. But I think no matter how angry you get, it's going to take a lot for you to, you know, crack a child's skull.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. You know, in even though a child's skull is probably less tough, even so, I can imagine it's still, you would still need to hit them with quite a bit of force to, you know, to do damage to their skull.
Exactly. So, yeah, you know, that's one theory. There's also, you know, fact, if you like, that the fingerprints on the bowl of pineapple, which was found to be JonBenet's system, belonged to Burke, her brother. He was interviewed at the time that the body was found. He was, you know, taken in by police and interviewed in the normal way. He didn't, you know, see anything. He gave perfect answers in the sense that he was innocent, and none of his DNA was on any of the rock or on her sort of blanket even. So he was quite quickly ruled out. It was just very strange that this bowl of pineapple only had his fingerprints on it and found in her system. A bit of a, I want to say a red herring, but that implies someone put it there. I don't want to imply that. So it's just weird. It's just weird.
Yeah, it's just strange. It's just strange. Unexplained. Strange and unexplained.
Strange and unexplained. So that's the family. But there is also a theory that there could have been an intruder who'd done it. This was partially brought about because there was an unidentified boot mark left on the floor in the basement room where JonBenet's body was found. There were quite a few suspects that they looked into as a result of that, including the family housekeeper, the local Santa Claus, who JonBenet had been to visit a little while before, and a man who lived locally who had committed suicide very shortly after her death. On the night of her death, two windows had been left ajar for Christmas lights. So you obviously have the wires, so they left the windows ajar to run the wires through so that they could be plugged in. As well as one door in the house being unlocked as well. So the whole thing about there being no force point entry was kind of ruled out by the fact that actually left two windows open and a door unlocked. So there doesn't need to be force point entry.
Yeah.
There was also in the basement a broken window, which had been broken prior to that knock that police believed someone could have come in from. However, that was really quickly ruled out. And honestly, I've included this because I think it's possibly the coolest thing I've ever heard. It was ruled out because on the inside of the window, there was an unbroken cobweb. And there's not going to be a cobweb if someone's come through that window recently.
An unbroken cobweb.
Right?
That's pretty cool.
Like that is pretty cool. Detective work at its finest.
Yeah, that's like Sherlock Holmes style.
Exactly. That little spider's. Yeah, man, I'm out here solving mysteries. So, yeah, there was quite a lot of reasons that people might have wanted to break in and take JonBenet, but unfortunately, many of them come back to being sexual. The child pageant arena had opened up to be visible to all sorts of people. There were, to kind of give you some perspective on, there were more than 100 burglaries Boulder in the months leading up to the murder, and there were also 30 registered offenders within a 2-mile radius. So if your mother, a child on the pageant circuit in that area, she is definitely being exposed, albeit, you know, unintentionally, to potential sexual predators, the supposed paedophilic Santa Claus that she'd been to visit. So people knew who she was. People knew where she lived. There's a fair few sex offenders.
How many did you say? 38?
38 within a 2-mile radius.
God damn. That's a lot.
I don't know if that's high. I mean, I haven't compared it to anywhere else, but it seems high.
It sounds high. I don't know what the standard is. No. But it sounds high.
It does sound
like
high.
Like 38 in a 2-mile radius sounds like a lot.
Yeah, exactly. But nonetheless, you know, there is definitely potential for any wanton paedophiles to have known who JonBenet was, where she lived, and taken the initiative to break and do something horrible. Yeah. There's also a theory that kind of combines two of these, which I really sincerely hope isn't true, but it is one that brought up. It's one that, you know, if you watch any of the documentaries on this case, or particularly casting JonBenet, which is on Netflix at the moment, refers to, talks about the case, and that there's a theory that Patsy Ramsey, who was obviously past their prime, wasn't in the Paget circuit anymore, was quite jealous of JonBenet's success and her kind of beauty, if you like, and was actually involved in offering her up to paedophiles. And what happened in the basement was a result of basically her allowing someone to come in and do what they were doing to JonBenet, and then obviously brought about a death.
Yeah.
I really hope that's not what happened, but obviously you could see how it would potentially be.
It's not an outlandish theory, but as you say, hopefully that's not the case.
But yeah, those are the two sort of main schools of thought. It was either a member of the family who then tried to cover it up, or it was an intruder who was very good at covering the tracks, but left a lot of things that look like the family have been involved. One thing I've also included, because I just thought it was, to be honest, fascinating and a little bit mental, was one of the false confession that came about as a result of the case. Obviously, anything like this is always going to bring about false confessions. People are mental and they want to take credit for things. But one of the false confessions was from a man called John Mark Carr, who is now known as Alexis Lauren Wright, I believe because of a sex change, who was arrested in Bangkok, Thailand on the 15th of August 2006. Following a false confession to murdering JonBenet. Wright was a 41-year-old school teacher who claimed she had drugged, sexually assaulted, and accidentally killed JonBenet. But later, authorities would find that there was absolutely zero, you know, circumstantial or friend to link her to the case. So I just think it's crazy that someone on the other side of the world was just like, no, I did it. It was me. Like, why would you want to take credit for that?
That is strange. Well, that's it. I mean, yeah, that's it. Why? And what would you gain from taking credit? False confessions are a bit of a head scratcher, aren't they? Like, I mean, why would you confess to something you didn't do?
Exactly that. It's very strange. But JonBenet's case is very much considered a cold case. You know, it's still open in Boulder, Colorado, but they haven't ever brought anyone kind of to justice over it, and no one really knows what happened, because there are just too many red herrings. There's too many elements that make it just a bit confusing.
Yeah.
But if we, right here on Horror House True Crime and the Club, had to pin it on someone, who are we pinning it on, Dor?
I knew you were going to do this.
I know. I just like putting you on the spot.
Oh, fuck's sake. I mean, I did it the other day, or our last recording. So, I mean, it doesn't sound like there's many suspects outside of the parents. And the parents have been a bit shady in ways. So, yeah, I don't know. I might have to sit on the fence on this one like I did last time. I think it was the case where I very much sat on the fence? Lizzie Borden.
Lizzie Borden, yeah.
What about you? What do you think?
Here's my theory, Dom. I'd love to claim full credit for it. It's not entirely mine. It's also wildly speculative. I don't claim to have any facts to back this up, although there are some logical elements to it. But here's what I think happened. I think Buck is incredibly jealous of his younger sister. I think he doesn't like the fact that she's getting attention for winning a lot of pageants. I don't think he liked the fact that, you know, she's a bedwetter and she's still getting all this attention. She's still like the golden child. So I think he wakes her up in the middle of the night. He takes her downstairs and he feeds her some pineapple because he's a good big brother and he wants her to know that he's looking after his little sister. So he feeds her a little bit. And I think he hits her over the head with something. I don't know what. He hits her with something. And obviously panics, didn't they did? So he goes upstairs and wakes up his mum. I think his mum goes downstairs. I think she takes her down into the basement and I think she strangles her and then puts the ransom note and all of the above in order to protect her now only remaining child from going to prison and being a convicted murderer at 9 years old. That's what I think. There wouldn't be any DNA. There was no reason that
that's logical.
I mean,
that's logical.
There was no weapon found for injury to her head. Any sort of blood or forensic evidence that was in the kitchen would have been wiped anyway, because, you know, all of those people were coming in and out, trying to, you know, help and not helping. The fingerprints and blood and, you know, was all not connected. So I think it's definitely possible. And it's the only explanation I can think of for the pineapple as well.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. That makes sense.
But that is the case of JonBenet Ramsey. And I think it's quite easy to see why it still remains. I think you should see us out if you're feeling brave.
Thank you for joining us for this week. Don't forget to follow us on your podcast app of choice and also on Instagram at horrorhouse_pod. Don't forget to leave a rating and a review. And don't forget to recommend us as well. Recommend us to everyone. Recommend us to your weird neighbor that you try and stay away from. Recommend us to your postman. Recommend us to the person that you've got a crush on. I see you crushing. Recommend us. Just recommend us to everyone, anyone and everyone. Don't forget to check out the Patreon account as well. And if you feel so inclined, check out the Buy Me a Coffee link. But thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed. And from me, all that's left to say, because I don't know if my voice can hold out that much longer, is stay spooky.